I just hit record here when they go to sidebar, right?
Yeah, and then...
Record, and then it automatically kicks on that level. Do I hit stop here or is that... This is just a record that needs to stop.
Oh, Vince. Where did Bill send you a question?
Is this where you're hunting? But not anymore. You don't have a house there anymore, do you?
The whole thing.
When they decided to kill us, when a baby actually decided to chase
it. What is now in session?
Morning, everyone. Please be seated. Did I make the right call yesterday, members of the jury, about the snow?
Thank you.
Seemed to be unanimous. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Kogan, you may begin.
Your Honor. All counsel, good morning, members of the jury.
Good morning.
I'm exhausted. I'm so out of it that I showed up here yesterday. Where were you?
I was here yesterday.
And I gave the speech to the judge. Just kidding. You might understand what this has been like. I know what it's like for you, and everybody thank you, and I join everybody. I add my voice to what everybody else said about how fortunate we are to have a jury like you. I was out a couple of days, and you weren't. And, look, I've been doing this a long time. This is not my first trial. You can tell that just by looking at me that I'm not a kid. And, of course, I let the cat out of the bag when I asked that guy who's the governor of Pennsylvania, wasn't I your intern, when he was not district attorney of Philadelphia, but when he was an assistant district attorney. And everybody, it's a matter of record how old our governor is. So, you know, I've been doing this for quite a while, but nothing like this. And when I say nothing like it, it has been physically and mentally debilitating. You may appreciate from what you heard in the evidence in this case, I won't say things that are outside the evidence in this case, of course. I got into this case rather late. Because you know from the evidence that you heard that as Richard Sprague was even writing for the United States Congress in late 2007 about selective prosecution, I got in after that. And you know that the trial started in September 2008, so reviewing tens of thousands of documents, both on the defense side and the prosecution side, it's just been absolutely extraordinary. Don't pity me, but I can tell you on the side of pity, I've spent more time with Ed Jacobs in the last 9 months than I have with my own wife, and vice versa. I mean, the wives are starting to raise their eyebrows. You know, when are you guys going to pick out furniture together, something like that. So it has been all those things, and I appreciate all the attention that you've given us, and I know that you're glad that we're coming to a conclusion, and we will be coming to a conclusion rather shortly. This process that you've been participating in is something so important to every one of us, the American jury system. I think back to a lot of thoughts that I've had over the years about what I want to say to juries to try to capture what this system really means. When I was a kid, I was very, very fortunate. I had parents who were absolutely terrific. I had a great childhood. We didn't own a bank. And I think there were probably years my father didn't have any money in the bank. But when reading the emails from my client to various people, including his daughter, Hi Pretty, and talks about, you know, the problems he had in childhood and some of the difficulties he had, I know that my childhood was a lot happier. And I had a grandmother who used to love to read to me. And she used to read me all these books when I was very, very small, long before I understood the words, long before educators and psychologists and psychiatrists came to understand that even when children don't actually understand the words, reading to a kid is really a good thing because at some level they're learning something. It's a cognition thing. And one of the books that my grandmother used to read to me was a book called Alice in Wonderland. Now, we used to think of it as a children's book back when I was a child, but as I grew older, I learned that it was a great classic. And it was something that I liked, and I know that my brother used to give me grief that, well, it's a girl's book. Why do you like it so much? The interesting thing about it in terms of the process that we're involved in is this. Many, many years later, when I attended law school, and we went through the first couple of days of being oriented to the classes that we had, property law, contract law, things that make your, you know, eyes close. The first day of criminal law, the professor, Dr. Stern, said, well, after today's lecture, let me give you the assignment for Thursday, being a Wednesday class. And we all expected that he'd ask us to read the great works of the great justices, like Felix Frankfurter, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Thurgood Marshall, as a learning, a tool to find out exactly what the Constitution means to the criminal law. And he said, tonight I'd like you to read a certain segment of Alice in Wonderland. And everybody laughed except me because he knew exactly who he was talking about. It was one day that I had a leg up on everybody else, maybe the last time. And you may remember the words. To the jury for about the 20th time that day, we will have the jury's verdict. No, no, said the Queen. Sentence first, verdict second. And little Alice said, stuff and nonsense. Who ever heard of such a thing? Sentence first, verdict second. If you start out with a conclusion, if you start out with feelings about what you think this case is about before the case goes to the jury deliberation room, it is somewhat like sentence first, verdict second. When the people who started this country, the ones that we call the Founding Fathers, set out to write a constitution that would last, just a block and a half away from here, on this historic ground. They were determined to erect barriers of protection between the people and their government. You might observe that the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, they constitute a series of negatives. Those things that government can't do to people. The First Amendment, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or religion. The Fourth Amendment, no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause. The Sixth Amendment, so vital here in this case, the right to counsel shall not be denied. But for the citizen accused, or anyone accused in this country, citizen or not, perhaps this is the most important one of all, the right of trial by jury. A jury that comes in absolutely not influenced by anything else that's out there, any of the thoughts that anybody else may have, a jury that comes in absolutely determined, absolutely swearing that they are determined to give a defendant the benefit of the presumption of innocence. A presumption of innocence that stays with every defendant throughout an entire case, and that presumption of innocence goes into the jury deliberation room. And that this presumption of innocence must be overcome by the government. And the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt, that a defendant is guilty to the satisfaction of a jury before that presumption of innocence can disappear. This standard, beyond a reasonable doubt, is the highest standard known in the law. I mean, you've heard in civil cases where the party that brings the suit's got to tip the scale ever so slightly in favor of their position. That's called the preponderance of the evidence. We have something called clear and convincing evidence. But beyond a reasonable doubt, on that test, the government must get an A. Now, this case that has occupied your time and ours almost exclusively these last 4.5 months. I got to tell you that I forgot how long we've been on trial. I didn't realize that March was approaching until Jacobs mentioned it the other day. I thought we were still in the middle of February. It's unusual in many ways. And not just because the allegations against my client fill 264 pages of that charging document that we call an indictment, the accusation. The accusations that were drawn up by the government in this case, phrased in the way the government chose to phrase them. And it's also unusual because in a case alleging political or public corruption, there are no bribes, there are no kickbacks, there are no instances of selling one's office, and there is no failure to provide an abundance, an overwhelming abundance of honest services to the public, which is what a public servant is supposed to do. And it's unusual also because we've been required to take so many side roads in this case. The government has taken us on side roads about such things as Ethics Act violations of other people in a case where my client is not charged with an Ethics Act violation. You saw that exercise when my client was on the witness stand, and on cross-examination, Mr. Pease hurled questions at him from digest summaries asking for interpretations and comments from my client about cases he had never seen, let alone studied before. And then on redirect examination, I came back and I asked Vince what he saw, and he said without studying them, what I could readily see is that many of these decisions involve townships and municipalities and school districts where perhaps, presumably, the work hour requirements were different than the rules that apply to the Senate of Pennsylvania, where maybe they have to be there a normal working day during a particular time of the day to do the job. Whereas in the Senate, and we could all repeat this, you've heard it so many times, 37.5 hours a week, but the specific time of the day or the week that the staffer must work is left to the discretion of the senator. More cases. The Habay decision, the one case that involves somebody from the General Assembly, from the lower chamber, the House, a decision by the Ethics Commission in 2004 involving staffers being forced to do political campaign work. And the staffers brought the complaint to the Ethics Commission in the first place, where there's no evidence that any of those people put in the required 37.5-hour work week that the House chamber has as well. The government assiduously avoided asking about the case that's most applicable to this one, and that's the Barbara Hafer case that my client talked about, the former Auditor General of Pennsylvania. In the Hafer case, she asked for an advisory opinion, and I really hate to even get into this because my client's not charged with an Ethics Act violation at all, but this is a side road we've had to travel. And in the Hafer decision, what she asked for was an advisory opinion about whether in her government-owned facility, owned by the government, by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, whether she could put in her own phone to do political campaign work and the like, even though it was in a facility owned by the government with government heating, government lighting, government desk where the phone was resting. And the Ethics Commission said, acknowledging the 24/7 nature of high-ranking elected public officials, it is understood that that is appropriate. It would have nothing less than, or more than rather, a de minimis economic impact. And anything with a de minimis economic impact is certainly no violation. And so when my client was on the witness stand and he was asked questions about Jamie Spagna on her own time, writing personal or political checks or doing personal or political things for my client, and he was asked questions about whether it was appropriate for her to be doing that on the basement floor in a building not owned by the government, owned by Citizens Alliance, not a government facility, it's a lease there where under the sweetheart terms of the lease the Senate couldn't even justify one half of one floor. And he said, to his everlasting regret out of the frustration that's been building all this time, I guess it was a mistake, I thought it was like spitting on a sidewalk. Shouldn't have said it. And you heard it repeated three times by Mr. Zosmer when he closed the other day. What economic impact? That she should have trotted up to the second floor, an area that is reserved for the Senate, or gone outside on the stoop outside to write a check that was personal in nature? A woman who the government says was an honest witness, but then chooses to ignore the fact that she testified that she did this other stuff at the workplace on Citizens Alliance property on her own time, and she put in about 50 hours a week generally doing the things she did that you heard her talk about. And the other stuff took about 4.5 hours a week, if I remember her testimony. You carry this to its logical conclusion, and you know what it comes to? It comes to the way the government raked over the coals the former district attorney of Montgomery County, Bruce Castor, who had the unmitigated gall and temerity to answer a subpoena that I issued, to have him come here and testify about the testimony of Christian Marone, who commented on direct examination presented by the government. This is not something that came up on cross-examination. Commented, Mr. Marone did, about what happened when he left Senator Fumo and went to work for Bruce Castor. Mr. Zosmer said, I don't know why they called Bruce Castor. What did that have to do with the case? You can't make this up. You can't make this up. What's he doing here? Well, you know exactly why Castor was called. Because Marone chose to say when he was called as a government witness on direct examination a number of things. First of all, he said that when he got to the DA's office, Castor approached him and said, I want you to work on my political campaign for running for district attorney because I have a view toward running for attorney general the year after that, the attorney general of Pennsylvania. Now, Castor approached him, almost like my client told him he's going to do the Green Street Project. When he came there thinking he was going to be doing public policy work, this guy, Marone, says, I go there thinking I'm going to be an assistant DA in a courtroom, and here the DA is calling me in and saying, I want you to do political campaign work. What happened after that? What happened after that was, for some reason, unbeknownst to me, that I can't even begin to understand, when questioned by the government, Marone said, I was fired 2 years later. Why? Because Bruce Castor loves himself, is what Marone said. Because I decided to exercise my rights and support his opposition, Corbett, who actually won. Castor said, that's not what happened. He was fired because he was a guy who came to me and said he wanted to work on my political campaign. I was somewhat taken aback when he did that. The junior staffer coming to me like that. The rest of my office, the people who have been with me for a long time, they're like family. Sound familiar? Like a family atmosphere. And I understood that. Here's a guy who's just starting out, coming to me as DA, and he wants to work on the political campaign. And he's telling me that he's helping me and supporting me, and I find out behind my back, without telling me, without ever approaching me, he's supporting the opposition. And I see that this guy's going into court representing me and my office, and I'm concerned that he's undermining me. I waited until after the primary, and then I fired him. Why? Because he's sneaky, and he's untrustworthy. So what does the government do in answering Bruce Castor, a two-term district attorney of Montgomery County, 2 terms before that, the first assistant district attorney of the county? They say, look at these emails between you and Mr. Marone. It's about political campaign work during the normal workday. Isn't that right? And you're using a county computer in a county building to do this political campaign work. No de minimis economic impact. Ridiculous, of course. Of course it is. What's he wearing out? The keyboard? So even that, carried to its logical conclusion, it's all about ethics act violations, the ethics police are out for you, carry it to its further conclusion in this case. Let's take a federal government employee, let's say a lawyer, let's not say a prosecutor, let's not personalize it, say a lawyer who goes in the court for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission every day, a government employee, and his spouse or her spouse calls on the telephone leaving messages with a government secretary over a government phone using a government pen or a government message pad. And where this stops, nobody knows. My client is not charged with an Ethics Act violation and a bunch of other things that have come up in this case. This case involves accusations of fraud and obstruction of justice. Specific intent crimes. Crimes that require a specific criminal intent. Obstruction of justice and fraud. Fraud. Charges that require, and you're going to hear this again, and you have the judge's instructions, you've heard them, and it'll be in front of you. A person commits a fraud if he devises a scheme or participates in a scheme to defraud. That is, to obtain money or property by materially, an important word, false or fraudulent representations, pretenses, or promises. That's one element. Two, that he acted at all times with the intent to defraud. And three, the intent to defraud means to act knowingly with the intent to deceive or to cheat, as well as a mailing or a wire transfer, depending upon the counts that we're talking about. So what is in Vince Fumo's mind, what his subjective beliefs are, they're all on the table. And nothing could be more important, that if there is no intent to defraud, there is no crime. And all the emails in the world, with all of the F-bombs that you'll hear at a Chris Rock comedy, a special on HBO, will not alter the simple fact that it is what is in his mind that is of paramount importance. Members of the jury, a person who, in good faith, honestly believes that what he is doing is proper, does not act with the intent to defraud. A person who, in good faith, honestly believes that what he's doing is not wrongful, does not act in a way that is consistent with the intent to deceive or to cheat. And if you find that that is so, and that the government did not prove the intent of the fraud, then an acquittal on every fraud count in this case is required. Now, when I first spoke to you on that balmy day last October, I told you that I predicted, and it turned out that I was right, that every aspect of my client's life would be on public display in this courtroom. And even his personal failures and human weaknesses would be dissected by the government. His extraordinary public achievements, they'd be relegated to a back burner. You wouldn't even see them. And since January 2004, his entire life has been under the powerful microscopic lens of the federal government. In this courtroom, here before you, for the period of time covered by this indictment, almost nothing has been off limits. Almost nothing. How much of a tip he leaves the crew on a ship or a boat or a yacht, whatever you want to call it, is raked over the coals. Even if he didn't know what the proper percentage was. His lost relationship with a daughter, a very, very complex subject, is publicly revealed. The pain over losing Dottie Eggery, a woman he loved and who he was obsessively jealous about when she dumped him for another guy. And then the anguish of having to watch her testify against them in this courtroom is all made public and becomes the stuff of which people giggle about. Mr. Zosmer says, look what he did. Look what he did. He had Wallace say, he says to Wallace, if she appears drunk, have her arrested. And if she loses her license, gets into a car again, have her arrested again. Ignoring the fact that even Wallace said that he was, in addition to being jealous and wanting to know who she was with, we frankly admit that, he was concerned about her drinking. Eggery said that he was always concerned about my drinking. You heard the testimony of Wallace that she jumped into a car, drove out of a restaurant called Tomatoes. She's barreling down Washington Avenue or Amherst Avenue in Margate, New Jersey, at about 90 miles an hour. We don't hear anything like that in Mr. Zosmer's closing speech to you. But Eggery. Eggery also said this. The one person who heard this term OPM that becomes the mantra for the government's case, that explains everything there is to know about the complex nature of Vince Fumo, the government says. She said also that he used the term OPM when he'd be using the credit card from his own bank. But she said this too. That despite all his faults, and she testified before the grand jury, if you remember, in response to questions by the government that he was socially retarded, they were her words, that there were two Vince Fumos, the public Vince Fumo and the private one, the public one who roars like a lion, the private one who's so shy that he clings to her at a social event. She said this too. She, who had more reason to be upset with him than anybody because he spied on her. I always knew him to be ethical. Always knew him to be ethical. The government introduces you to Vince Fumo by introducing an avalanche of emails, profanity-laced emails, emails with nasty comments, emails that reveal sometimes a boorish and even dictatorial nature, as though we can understand it through the lens of the person who's reading it, is usually somebody he knows and has a relationship with. And we see, for example, that a self-avowed liberal Democrat concerned about government intrusions and invasions of privacy himself invades the privacy of his girlfriend. The government says or suggests, we don't do this to poison your mind against them in any way, to show you all the profanity-laced emails or to prejudice you in any way. We show you these emails, emails by the hundreds, to show you that this is a demanding boss who requires people to do things for him. And then, of course, what the government does not even want to dwell on is this, what you heard in evidence in this case, the familial nature of the relationships of the people on Tasker Street and in Harrisburg. Fumo says it's a family atmosphere. Mike Pogorski said the culture in the Senate office is that it was one like one big family. And if you have any doubt about whether that's being, we're leveling with you about that, and you remember the testimony of the people who appeared here, it's revealed also in one of the first exhibits that we showed, Marone. and you've heard it, and you've seen it, and it's Exhibit 499, Defense Exhibit 499. And when we introduced it to show you the venom that Marone had. And this is the email, and Mr. Shapiro has it on the screen, but let me just, this is where, and there's a bigger point to make here about the family nature of the relationships that occur at his office. This subject, Aunt Nancy DeSimone. This is about his Aunt Nancy. Aunt Nancy died this afternoon. She had cancer, but it didn't exhibit itself until very recently. I was with her yesterday. She died peacefully in her sleep. She enjoyed a happy Thanksgiving and Christmas, and now she is with God. And then, of course, the email later on from Christian Rohn to his wife, because she's one of the recipients of the email, he says, "What shit? She sleep with God. He doesn't even believe in God." But what I want you to dwell on now is this. If you look at this email and you review this exhibit, look at who the email goes to. The usual suspects. The people who you saw in this case, whose names you heard. People on his staff. Not just his immediate family, like his son Vincent, or his daughter Allie, or his former wife Jane Scicchetti. What it does here, when he's even referring to Aunt Nancy, not my Aunt Nancy, but Aunt Nancy, as though it's everybody's aunt, it goes to Jamie Spagna, it goes to Marianne Cortullo, it goes to Lillian Cazzo, it goes to people who are former staffers like Jim Kenney and Frank DiCicco, it goes to people like Charlie Hoffman, it goes to Dugalecki in Harrisburg. All those people, it's a family. So that when he says to somebody, without saying, "Please, may I ask you to do me a favor," you understand that they're looking at this differently than we're looking at it. Ask yourselves, after seeing this thing displayed in this courtroom with all these emails, would you be comfortable not crafting your emails very carefully in the future? Crossing every T and dotting every I for fear that someday they'll be flashed on computer screens in a courtroom somewhere or dissected by the government? Would you be comfortable if you're even writing to your closest friend or a loved one, your wife, a lover, to make sure nothing's going to be misinterpreted later on? If you're someone like my client and you understand that that's exactly what may happen down the road, you don't say, "Do this, do that, FFF, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark." What you do is you say, "Please, do me a favor. I'm busy on 19 projects right now. Could you go and let the contractor in on Green Street? And if you don't want to do it, it's okay. There will be no repercussions." Would you even think, after seeing this revealed in this courtroom, about not even emailing again or surfing the net, going to certain websites, or being on Facebook or something like that for fear that people will see what you're all about? Such is the reality of our now not so private world and thoughts. This nightmare began for Ruth and for Vince in early 2003. You'll remember that there was an Inquirer news story that said that law enforcement was looking into one-day liquor license for special events. And somehow, this was a buzz or something in South Philadelphia that law enforcement was asking about it. And the article said something about Ruth Arneo. Government immunized witnesses Frank Wallace said, "I looked into it, I investigated, Ruth did nothing wrong, nor did anybody on the FUMO staff. And nothing ever came of it, except the deepening suspicion that your enemies will take something that's absolutely nothing and try to make something out of it." November 2003, it was something else. Vicki Humphreys said that she began to focus on whether or not certain things that they were learning that were covered, for example, in the Inquirer story in November 2003 about PICO making contributions to Citizens Alliance and the further publicity about Verizon, whether or not Senator Fumo attempted to extort the utilities that he opposed in public utility litigation before the PUC. There was no secret about the public litigation before the PUC. What may be lost in all this is the government brought in the people from the utilities. Dan Whalen from Verizon. They brought in Tom Hill and the people from PICO, including Corbin McNeil, with whatever preserved paperwork they had in light of their own document retention policies. And they heard their versions, and nothing ever came of it. Because the settlements in those matters arose from real litigation between parties. Fumo in his private and public capacity. Litigation before the PUC. What was behind it all, as you now know, is one public person's longstanding opposition to big business utilities and the sway they had with the PUC. Then January 25th, 2004, you know what happened. On January 25th, 2004, more Inquirer headlines. This time, FBI probes Fumo deal. And it's about Verizon. And what does Fumo say on the witness stand? It was like a punch in the stomach. There is no evidence or any indication that there's a grand jury investigating it. There's no formal word that there is really a criminal investigation here. It's unnamed sources in a newspaper. There is no search warrant like the one that was later issued on Tasker Street 13 months later. A newspaper story about a probe, the underlying subject, which he had every reason to be extremely proud of. It was like a punch in the stomach, he said. And you remember what he said. Sprague thought it was nothing audible. And I thought perhaps, in light of the article, that citizens would be audited by the FBI or the IRS. And you heard Mr. Zosmer say, how ridiculous. Everybody knows that the FBI doesn't audit. They do criminal investigations. Well, that's all reflected. What his state of mind is reflected in his note a day or two later to his friend, the beloved Marcus, about getting the plane to bring him back to Philadelphia. And it's government 1473T, and what is revealed is what's in his mind. Is this computer on? I come over here. While you're doing that. This is revealed just a couple of days later, reflecting everything that my client told you on the witness stand about this. It says to Marcus, according to Dick and many others, the article was a nothing article, but the effing headline was devastating. To the point that I didn't even want to go out to dinner last night because I didn't want to run into the people who might have read it. That effing paper is not going to let go. They are on my ass for some reason and think that by pounding me, they will nail me somehow. So far, I'm sure the stories about citizens will get the feds, IRS plus and or FBI, to at least audit citizens. That's what's in his mind. And when that happens, there will be more stories. Citizens is working with Dick's office on this contingency right now. And he goes on, Marcus, to say he doesn't want Dottie Eggery on the plane because they've gotten back together for a short period of time, and he doesn't like her. Chris Craig, his reaction. It was the day that changed my life. Mr. Zosmer, see how he got choked up on the stand? He began to break down because he did not know that when that money went to Citizens Alliance, how it was going to be spent. And so Senator Fumo let him down. Now, of course, Chris Craig wasn't asked any questions about his reaction or his opinion. The government didn't dive into that waterless pool to ask him whether or not he thought that the man who brought $17 million of private PICO money to Citizens Alliance would be overstepping his bounds if he got anything out of it at all. Perks, gifts, compensation in kind, whatever you want to call it. What Craig broke up about was this. I felt like the Inquirer was crapping all over our years of hard work. And what extraordinary work it was, members of the jury. Now, I don't want to get into the litigation again. Your eyes will glaze over. You had to hear us cross-examine witnesses about it, about what happened with PICO and what happened with Verizon. But I dare not let it go because the government gets a chance to rebut whatever we say here today. And the stuff about Verizon and PICO is the archway to what the government says is intentional obstruction of justice. So the background of what happened, without delving into all those details that took a long time of examination when Hill was here and testified, when Whalen was here and testified, and what Chris Craig told you about the intricacies of the litigation, need to be touched on in a little bit of overview, and that's all it will be. You know the background, what happened in the legislature, in his official capacity as a senator, when the General Assembly enacted legislation deregulating electric provider service in the state of Pennsylvania. But at the same time, what happened was the Senate authorized PICO, which was by far the largest provider of electric service in the state of Pennsylvania, to petition the PUC for 100% recovery of its so-called stranded costs, which was at that time PICO's very, very poor investment in nuclear power plants. They should have held on to it. If they didn't, it's a big mistake, because if we don't do something about the energy problem in this world, folks, we're going nuclear. There's no question that's what's going to happen. But at the time, it was a very bad investment. And what FUMO was concerned about, you heard in the testimony of Chris Craig, was the way they were going to recover these stranded costs is they were going to charge them back to the ratepayers. And that he asked for and tried to get and introduced on the floor of the Senate an amendment requiring that there be substantial reductions, guarantees that the generated rates that we pay that are reflected in our monthly bills are reduced. He lost. He didn't have enough votes with all the Democrats that they had. They couldn't make a majority, and he lost in the Senate. But he did something that was uncharted territory for him, or probably anybody else. He went to the PUC as a litigant. He went to file a suit. There is nothing that prohibits it. There is nothing that discourages it. He was pioneering something that hadn't been done before. And he goes there with Chris Craig, and his appearance is entered not only as Senator FUMO, but in his individual capacity as a ratepayer and a taxpayer. And the litigation is knocked down, drag out. And Chris Craig, who comes in modestly and says, I knew nothing about public utility law, and the consumer advocacy groups help me, like Steve Hershey. These guys do great work. They usually get their teeth kicked in before the PUC, the consumer advocates, but they do great work, and I learn from them. And what happens? There's a new sheriff in town. PICO knows that they're not going to walk all over the place with consumer advocacy groups. They all line up behind Senator FUMO and Chris Craig. You remember the exhibits shown to Hill by the government. They're trying to come up with talking points. How are you going to deal with this guy? How do you solve a problem like FUMO? That's the sound of music. How do you solve a problem like FUMO? And here's what you do. Here's how you handle it. Make sure he understands, and Craig understands, that we can't afford in early years any kind of serious rate reductions. We can't get guarantees, anything like that. Let's deal with it this way. And how does Chris Craig respond to it all? He'll have none of it. Defense Exhibit 747, this is his response. Now, this is a fax, and I have a hard copy. Here's what he says. You can blow it up. Rate decreases for consumers. We're not going to hear anything else. This is what we want. The amounts of the guaranteed minimum rate reduction specified in Table 1 are too low, especially in the initial years. Going down to the third paragraph, this type of annual review of PICO assumes, and it goes on, and it says, consumers are unwilling to accept on faith the assertion that price competition for energy supply and incentives by market suppliers will result in further prior reductions for consumers. They get the message. After knockdown, drag-out litigation before the PUC, uncharted territory for any Pennsylvania senator you heard, they decide to come to the table. To settle the matter, not only in his capacity as a senator, but he's also in there as an individual litigant, as a taxpayer, and as a ratepayer. A lawsuit that you could bring, I could bring,
but obviously very few people will pay attention if I do it. But he brings it, and they have to deal with him. So they have round-the-clock settlement discussions, bringing this to what they think is a conclusion, beginning in Senator Fumo's Dilworth office with all the consumer advocacy groups there following him. And what happens? The next day, they reach a resolution. And Chris Craig says to Senator Fumo, his boss, you know what? You know, I'm learning from the consumer groups. They do these side deals, these side letters, off-the-record side letters, because there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing illegal about it. The PUC is either going to accept a proposal based on its revealed terms or they're not. These guys are getting like $3 million for their groups. This is billions of dollars to PICO. This is pennies on the table for them. You can ask for things. And then he and the CEO, later chairman of the board of PICO, Corbin McNeil, either go into another room or they're at the end of a conference table, depending upon whose version and recollection you can credit here, and they have a discussion. And Vince says on the witness stand, Corbin says to him, you know, it's you we had to get out of this case. Why? Well, because you've always been an opponent of PICO. You have access to the bully pulpit. People will listen to you. You've got the fire in the belly to continue with this litigation. And also, Vince, you're a pain in the ass. So he asked for something. $3 million for Citizens Alliance, and later on when they settle the other matter, the merger matter, because PICO has a merger in mind that later on ends up and they're becoming a company called Exelon, there's another $4 million, all paid out over a span of time. But the other thing he asked for is to bury the lines in the Spring Gardens section, something that becomes impractical. You hear about it, and after a study, and then everybody comes to understand how disruptive it will be in the Spring Gardens section. They all agree not to do this, and it is PICO that says, how about if we give another $10 million to Citizens Alliance? This is pennies on the table over this litigation. So now you have $17 million of private money, not public grant money. There is no suggestion that he ever got a gift or any kind of perk or any salary from Citizens Alliance when it was public grant money. It's 1998 when it is PICO that's shelling out $17 million of private money based on public and private litigation that goes over to Citizens Alliance that some of the things you heard about in this case begin. Extraordinary. Later on, the PUC says timeout because they don't like the settlement. They say, Chris Craig says, you know, the PUC is a real piece of work. What they're really saying, if you read through that 110-page opinion, not the two or three paragraphs that Mr. Peace made reference to when he cross-examined Chris Craig, what they're really saying is this. What they wanted the PUC was, think of it as two pots. They wanted to take a little bit from PICO, and they did, and take a little bit from the ratepayers and put it over here in a third pot to facilitate the entry into the market of the independent marketers led by Enron. And you heard what happened. Enron, with their lobbyists and advertising campaign, tried to blow up the original settlement. And then in classic style, and you heard it, Ken Lake from Enron comes up to Pennsylvania to see Tom Ridge and Senator Fumo. And Senator Fumo is not the shy guy in the Dottie Eggery lexicon when he's dealing in a private matter. This is his milieu. And, to put it nicely, eventually he shows them, the people from Enron, the door, with, I'm sure, very nice language attached to it. Eventually, the PUC approves a settlement, which is not quite as good as the one that Chris Craig and Vince Fumo worked out initially, but still darn good. And what was it? Rate decreases starting in 1999, 8 to 10% a year, rate decreases for generated electric rates. And then once it phases in 2006, a freeze, a cap at 1996 rates. And that's what he did in this litigation. In addition to getting $17 million for Citizens Alliance. This is one of the things that the government starts this case out with, an investigation over that. Verizon. That Telecommunications Act passed by the United States Congress in 1996 was significant, or so it seemed at that time. Without getting into all the details of how this all happened, Congress said that local exchange carriers like Bell of Pennsylvania could enter the long-distance market, which at that point had been dominated by AT&T and MCI and Sprint. But they had to give up their virtual monopoly on local telephone service. And you know the rest of the story. What happened? How do you give them all the incentives in the world to do that? And what they had to do was they needed a code of conduct. They wanted in the Senate, in litigation, or rather legislation led by Senator Fumo, structural separation. This goes on, and you know what happens. Through their powerful lobbyists, they kill this bill, and it never makes it to the floor of the Senate. The structural separation that Fumo and Craig want, followed by Madigan and White, those other senators. Without getting into the further details about what happens, he enters again as a private litigant, as a ratepayer, as well as Senator Fumo before the PUC, and he also opposes them on their proposed merger. And what comes of it? What Whalen says he does is he gets his lobbyist, Wojak, who's got a decent relationship with Fumo, to try to settle it. And Wojak comes back and he tells him something about he wants contributions to Citizens Alliance and this group and that group, and he wants structural separation. That means the wholesale unit cannot talk to the retail unit. You heard all the stories about what they were concerned about. So there would be robust competition, and that he was opposed to the merger. The Bell Atlantic that had almost a virtual monopoly in Pennsylvania, largest by far of all the exchange carriers, wanted to merge with the second biggest, GTE. Robust competition? No way. You heard what happened. Whalen first says, look, we can't reward those who are adversaries at first, he says, because those who are our friends are going to want even more. And we're a regional company. We give a lot more than what PICO does. We cover a bigger territory. So what happens is they sit back smugly, and then the impossible happens. The atomic bomb, as far as Verizon is concerned, Bell Atlantic. The PUC and the litigation that is being championed by Vince Fumo and Chris Craig order structural separation, which they can't possibly have. And so what happens is Whalen, and you heard his testimony, he decides that they've got to appeal it to Commonwealth Court. And what does he do? We go out and hire a lawyer. And don't hold it against the lawyer, because he never knew what the reason was why they called him in, the lawyer, this guy Tom Leonard. We wanted a guy who had facial recognition with the judges, a guy who is a political fundraiser, and by the way, a good lawyer. And Tom Leonard, you never said anything to him about why you were hiring him, did you? And he said no, Whalen, when he was on the stand. What happens eventually is that he goes, Whalen does, to a firm, Ballard, which is headed by, of all people, David Cohen, the former chief of staff of Ed Rendell, and Art McAdon is the managing partner. And they go back and they tell him what he should do is he should try to settle with Senator Fumo. And so he goes back with Wojak, he goes to see Fumo, and during the course of trying to settle the matters between them, they have discussions about settling the private aspect of the matter that Senator Fumo is involved in, by getting some business to law firms like Dilworth, which had originally had the legal business of Verizon before. We have no problem giving out that legal business, Whalen said, because that's what we do. We give out a lot of legal business. They recoil at the idea that Dilworth is going to get anything because Senator Fumo is a member of the firm. They have discussions about the Cozen firm, and the long and short of it is that Fumo wants to at least get a law firm in Philadelphia, one that he recommends the business, and Obermeyer ends up with it. The litigation is settled. There is no complete structural separation. What they get is something called partial separation. This the government investigates as though it is a possible extortion. Nothing ever became of it because, in fact, there was no extortion. What this was about was one public servant's concern about big business utilities. Now, headline story. What does Howard Kane say? Publicity like this is like a torpedo hit, especially for a public official in an election year. It's not only an election year for Vince Fumo, it's a presidential election year as well. George W. Bush is running for re-election. And what happens is, you see the article, and the government says that after the article appeared in the Inquirer, the cover-up begins. The obstruction of justice begins. And let's just try to wrap our brains around this for a second. 1476. G-1476. This is the cover-up. An email sent out asking all these people to destroy their emails. An email that goes out to all these people as though this is a secret of some kind. You might think, that's ridiculous. How could this be considered part of a cover-up? How could this be considered part of obstruction of justice? How could anybody think that? This email is sent to all these different people before we even get into who's on this list. 29 people, and I asked the question a few times, and I wasn't being facetious. You click that mouse, or you put the cursor on the forward button accidentally. This thing can be not only halfway around the world, all the way around the world within minutes. I mean, this can be in Mozambique in about 5 minutes. That's exactly how our world has shrunk. This could be probably in India. You know, when you call Comcast for some computer help, you're talking in about an instant. You're talking in an instant to somebody from India, a service representative. All these people. That email is sent to all those people. And look at the people on the list. This secret. First person, Pat Freeland. She naturally read the article in the newspaper that day. Pat Freeland, a lawyer. Remember the lawyer you heard on the witness stand? She's organizing farm workers when she's a kid. Somebody who leaves her cushy job at Pepper, Hamilton and Sheets, to run the Spring Garden Community Development Corporation to rehab an entire community. What we used to call in the 60s a do-gooder. A lawyer. She gets this email. Bob Scandone never saw this, he said. That's what Bob Scandone said. One of his dearest friends is the subject of an article that everybody except people on Saturn saw earlier that afternoon. He didn't see this He didn't see this email. Frank Wallace, a former inspector of the police department. This is part of the secret. And it goes on and on. Ken Snyder. If Ken Snyder hits the wrong button or sends it to the wrong place, instead of some Republican committee man in Oklahoma, maybe he'll get lucky this time and it'll end up right in the heart of the Bush White House. This is the secret. Adrian Thomas, another lawyer, and all these other people. Nobody sees that there's anything wrong with this. Nobody views this as the obstruction of justice that the government says. Nobody says so much as a peep about wiping BlackBerries, bring in your computers for security updates. Use PGP security now more than ever. You know what this section of the Crimes Code, U.S. Code, requires? This obstruction of justice count, 1512B2B. The elements are that the people involved, that is my client, who's charged. He's charged. This is count 111 of the indictment, obstruction of justice. That he knowingly, corruptly persuaded Luchko and these other people, presumably, to destroy or alter documents to keep it from the government in a grand jury proceeding or some other official proceeding. That's the government's argument. I mean, to send it to all these people would be like saying these people in the workplace that there are two people at the workplace having a relationship, a man and a woman. They don't want anybody to know about it, and they send out an email to everybody on the staff explaining where they had their Valentine's dinner the night before. But this isn't the first one. The first count is 110. That's December 1st, 2003. December 1st, 2003, there's an email that goes out. This is after the PICO articles where there's no suggestion of any investigation, where PICO says that they admit that they gave money to Citizens Alliance, but not how much, do you remember? This is to inform all of you that under any circumstances, are you to save any email from or to the senator? This would include all mail you receive from him in your inbox and all mail you sent to him that is stored in your sent items. And he goes on. Government says, you know, that was really unusual, wasn't it? Even though what we have here is this following the PICO articles, there's no indication of any investigation about any of this. There's no indication of any grand jury proceeding about any of this. There had been something in early 2003, we heard from Agent Humphreys, about a subpoena served on Citizens Alliance at about the time we hear that they're investigating these one-day liquor license matters. Who knows what that was about? This is obstruction of justice. The government says they never did this kind of thing before. Oh, we found something in October of 2000, and that was highly unusual about, you know, not saving emails. Mr. Shapiro put it on the screen, the October of 2000. This is where the question is asked, do we have a system, this is from Senator Fumo, to even coin in Harrisburg? Do we have a system of checking all staff computers, including laptops, to make sure that all of my emails are deleted on a regular basis, at least monthly? Mr. Zosmer says something must have spooked him. This comes out of nowhere. We didn't find a lot of these things over the years. Even though you heard witnesses from Tasker Street say that that was exactly the practice. We would get these things from time to time. And the government says, well, is that really true about wiping and all the rest of it? And then the government says, no, this is something that must have spooked them. But then you know what we do know about this. And that is what Dan Coyne said in his testimony when he testified in court. What he says is this. Mr. Shapiro will get it for us. And I just want to go over the highlighted areas. This is a question asked by Mr. Jacob. Go up a little bit. All right. Wasn't it crystal clear to you that Senator Fumo did not want email saved? Answer, I did what he asked, and my understanding was that he didn't want you to save his emails. Okay, so I guess the issue here is whether that is a policy or not. So let's use the word direction. Wasn't it Senator Fumo's direction that emails not be saved? Answer, yeah. Question, and that goes back years, doesn't it? Answer, yeah, I guess. Question, well, let's not guess. You started with the Senate back in June of 1996, right? Answer, yes, sir. That was the email policy back then, wasn't it? I don't recall for certain. Question. Well, do you ever recall a time when that was not his direction to delete emails? No, he says. You don't recall a time when it was not. And then it's cut off at that point. So going back to when he started, 1996, 1997, that was it. And then he goes on to talk about this, and Mr. Jacobs asks about wiping. Remember the testimony you gave right before the break about wiping, and I think you said to Mr. Peace you had never done that before? Answer, I never said that. Question, well, perhaps I misunderstood it. This exhibit that we just looked at, 1477 in January of 2004, does refer to wiping computers, right? Answer, yes, sir. So it would not be correct to say that January of 2004 was the first time you did any wiping of computers, would it? Answer, no, I've wiped computers before. Question, now under what circumstances did you wipe computers before January of 2004? And here's his answer. It was part of the regularly scheduled maintenance, so to speak, that I would perform on the senator's computers. I mean, you know, and I would also do it to my own. Question, and how often did you wipe the senator's computers before January of 2004? Not every time I would visit his computer, monthly, maybe less. This had been the practice on Tasker Street and even in Harrisburg where Coyne was, but this was not being carried out over the years, as he finds out in January of 2004, wondering who's leaking this stuff to the press. So it was a practice. It was an accepted practice. And what happens is this. Chris Craig alone. Dick Sprague thinks the January 24th, 2005 article was a nothing article, January 25th, 2004. But Chris Craig is the eternal pessimist. He says, I think someday I may have a subpoena coming to me. I may have to testify about this in light of that article. So what do? I begin to gather together all of my documents, all of my records, all the things that I think may be necessary, and I realize I have no emails because I delete and purge as a matter of practice, and so does Vince. So he calls in Deb McGuire, the head of computer services in Harrisburg, the chief tech up there, and she says, we don't have any emails. We can't get them because the server was changed in early January of 2003. So there are no emails. And what happens? He says, my client does, that he relates this to Dick Sprague. And he says to Dick Sprague, this father figure, this friend of his, he says, Dick, there are no emails. Is that a problem? And Sprague, according to Vince Fumo, says, if it's not specifically subpoenaed, you don't have to save it. I never said that, says Richard Sprague. Richard Sprague says, I would never say anything like that. I remember when somebody once won all of the charges in a case against them, but he was convicted of obstruction of justice. I never said it to him. I never thought about saying it to him. Fast forward 2 years. Conversation. At Sprague's house with Senator Fumo. Can you see this? Conversation at Senator Fumo's, at the Richard Sprague's house, which is Defense Exhibit 722.3. Conversation involving Richard Sprague, the father figure lawyer that he looks up to, Jeff Johnson, the lawyer from the Sprague firm who's taking these notes, Mark Shepard, the other lawyer who's involved in this case, and with Vince Fumo, and what do we see reflected in the notes? BJF always believed no obligation to save anything until you get a subpoena. Where did he get this idea? RAS did as well. Richard Sprague, I never thought that. I never said anything like that. We were talking about some other lawyer who thought that. I always knew better. RAS did as well. Thus, if BJF got an email saying they were cleaning up stuff, BJF didn't think it was a problem. Words mean what they seem to mean, not what Mr. Sprague and the government says they mean. He was told that back in January 2004, if it's not specifically subpoenaed, you don't have to save it. And what happens? Citizens Alliance first gets a subpoena on April the 28th, 2004. It's a subpoena for Citizens Alliance. It is not a subpoena for Senator Fumo individually, and it's not a subpoena calling for production of documents in the Senate office. It is a subpoena for Citizens Alliance documents or things, and you heard my cross-examination of Agent Humphreys. A subpoena calls for production of documents or other things called for in the subpoena as of the day that the subpoena is served. Those things that are in existence at the time. Documents created in the future, emails written a month later or 2 months later, are not within the scope of what the subpoena required to be produced. But this is a subpoena for Citizens Alliance and nothing else. So what happens is this. On the day that the subpoena comes or the next day, Robert Scandone, the attorney, longtime friend of Senator Fumo and criminal lawyer who's practiced in every court from here to the World Court at The Hague. You heard him testify. Criminal lawyer. You heard his testimony the day before I had a chance to cross-examine him. And what did he say? I didn't know why Dick Sprague wanted to set me up. I thought that this is crazy. You got the impression that the conversation never took place. Here's the letter that was sent at Sprague's request. And I won't read the whole thing. If you go down to the last paragraph. briefly, Senator Fumo asked my advice as to what effect the subpoena the Citizens Alliance had on him and or his staff. I told him that Citizens was a separate entity and that its attorneys were required to respond with responsive records. If in connection with Citizens' response, he and his staff were asked to cooperate, that they should do so, though they were under no specific obligation to do so. Here's the important part. I further explained that if the grand jury sought records from his office, that he and or his staff members would be subpoenaed directly. Finally, I advised him, because this subpoena was not directed to him or his office, there was no reason for him or his staff to do anything other than what was done in the normal course of business. He's being advised. You don't have to say things that are not specifically subpoenaed. That's from Dick Sprague. Scandone, the criminal lawyer, is telling him on April the 28th, 2004, when the subpoena comes for Citizens Alliance documents and nothing else, that it's business as usual in the Senate office. What is business as usual? What does Scandone know business as usual is as of April 28, 2004, 1476? What is business as usual as he understands it in the Senate office as of that date? January 25, 2004, just 3 months earlier, this is business as usual. All emails sent to BJF until further notice should be sent using PGP. Anyone who is currently using a BlackBerry is to refrain from sending any sensitive information on it. Anyone who is using a BlackBerry is to set up a time with Don or myself so we can wipe them. Anyone is using a laptop is to set up a time with Don or myself so that we can run security updates. That's business as usual. And that's the advice that he's being given as of April the 28th, 2004. And so now we come full circle. What is in his mind? What is in my client's mind? What is his belief? We didn't get into this when we had Mr. Sprague on the stand. Look at what comes right after that. I know sometimes it's really hard to be fair. BJF's view on Citizens' subpoena. Citizens' records couldn't be touched. That's what was subpoenaed. On his own email, never thought about it, policies did not change April 2004 to February 2005. Words mean what they seem to mean, not what Sprague says they mean. Not what the government wants you to think they mean. Members of the jury, there is no evidence in this case, forensic or otherwise, that a single Citizens Alliance document that had been created before April 28, 2004, the day the subpoena was served, was destroyed or altered after April 28, 2004. Vince Fumo's belief was Citizens subpoena, Citizens records couldn't be touched. On his own email, never thought about it. Policies did not change. Does this sound like somebody who's got a specific criminal intent to obstruct justice in this case? Does this sound like somebody who's being given good legal advice about what he should do or shouldn't do? It is firmly implanted in his mind, as we shall see, and I think you will understand this completely when we put this together. It is firmly implanted in his mind that it's only the Citizens Alliance documents that we're talking about here. But in an abundance of caution, what does he do? As of June 2004, he again writes to Dick Sprague. And you know what happens. As background, before we get to that, Mr. Shapiro already has it up on the screen. As background, here's what happens. Luchko is talking about the Senate server and computer over on Tasker Street. And his hair is on fire. This guy's got his own feelings about the federal government. And what he says is this, and it's important for you to know what is being forwarded to Richard Sprague here. This is June 7th, 2004. This is Luchko writing to Fumo, and he says, "Boss, I want to run a couple of things by you that I think we should start doing until this FBI thing blows over. I know the FBI is on a fishing expedition. I remember what they tried to say. There was a mob operating down the Navy Yard when I worked down there. They ran a 16-month covert investigation with agents disguised as workers, and their main weapon was entrapment. You see, it's not about upholding the law with them. It's about building careers. This is his state of mind. In the end, they arrested 15 people for the most trivial things. All of them were tricked into breaking the law. I know this because when they were all arrested, the stupid FBI put them all in the same cell, and they compared notes and realized they were all entrapped. And then he goes on to talk about it. So if I seem paranoid, I have good reason. My apprentice instructor drilled one thing into my head that always stayed with me throughout my career. Always cover your own butt. Now, go down a little bit. Scroll it. What I want to do is going to make Don and my life miserable and less efficient, but it's only temporary. First, we keep our daily backup tapes at the office for easy access in case we have to recover files quickly. I want to take them all home and just bring the ones I need that day to work. If we need to recover files, if you take that arrow away, it would help. I would have to go home and get the tape. So now we know what he is planning is to take tapes home. He says, second, we keep certain files on the server that we need but are sensitive. They are encrypted, but the FBI got a hold of them. They can compel us to open them. What are the files? These aren't Citizens Alliance files. These files included passwords files, copies of everyone's PGP keys, equipment files, credit card information, wireless network configuration, encryption numbers, et cetera, et cetera, P disks and the like. And he goes on to say, this is very dangerous, but if it has to be done, we'll do it. What does Vince Fumo do? He forwards this to Dick Sprague, June 7, 2004, his father figure, his dear friend, the guy that he looks up to. Dick, I think these are good ideas. And since nothing has been subpoenaed from me, I think all of this would be legal. I'm going to proceed unless you say no. Does this sound like somebody who's trying to obstruct justice? The government asks, but you don't want the FBI rummaging around in your materials. No, I didn't. The exchange between Mr. Peace and my client, it's nothing I brought up. My client says, no, I don't trust you. I don't trust the FBI. I didn't trust the FBI for a long time. I didn't trust the FBI, especially, you know, in the aftermath of the Patriot Act. I don't believe in the administration's policies. That's what he says. He says, it's well known that I'm the largest fundraiser among Democrats in the entire country as far as state legislators are concerned. This is a presidential election year, and Pennsylvania is a swing state. These are the things that are in his mind that came out during the cross-examination by Mr. Peace of my client. These are the things that he's thinking. None of this is under subpoena as far as he's concerned. And he's being told, if it's not specifically subpoenaed, you don't have to save it. Sprague now has noticed that they're going to take things off the server. What's that mean? They're going to be wiping the server. He knows that. That's exactly what they're proposing. And my client innocently says to him, none of this seems like it's illegal. I haven't been subpoenaed. I'm not going to do anything unless you tell me it's okay. And Sprague says, we get together at my office, and we say it's okay. So Mr. Sprague is already on notice, as of June 7, 2004, that they're wiping things, taking things off the server, and things are going over to Luchko's house. Do you know much later in this case, in count 141, they go to Luchko's house, the government does, and they search his house, and they find records. These backup tapes. My client gets indicted after getting that advice from counsel that it's okay to do this. My client gets indicted in count 141 because of those things that were at Luchko's house and not turned over when Sprague's firm was dealing with production of documents in relationship to subpoenas and the search warrant that had been issued and executed on Tasker Street, which I'm about to get to. If you have any further doubt in your mind that my client is acting in a good faith belief based on what he has heard, that it's only Citizens Alliance documents that couldn't be touched, you need no go no further than Exhibit 1550, Government Exhibit 1550. And why is this so significant? And if we get all these arrows off the screen, okay. Now, how do we get all these arrows out?
Bottom left. Touch the bottom left of the screen.
Great. How did that happen? This is very important, so that there is absolutely no question that he's trying to comply with the requirements of the law as he understood it. This is an email from Luchko. To go to the bottom. Howard just dropped off, this is Howard Kane. Howard just dropped off his laptop for us to check. We're going to totally reload it so we know it is wiped clean. Have Charlie, this is what Senator Fumo says, have Charlie check with Jeff Johnson on that first, as there may be a subpoena issued for some information. And then Luchko explains, go up. Howard told me they, FBI already took it and gave it back to him, but I will check. Remember what happened. You heard the testimony. Howard Kane was the first, it appears anyway, to be brought before the grand jury. And he's brought before the grand jury just days before this email. I read what took place before the grand jury. The first question that was asked by Mr. Peace of Howard Kane was, we've brought you in here to ask you questions about PICO and Verizon and our ongoing investigation involving Senator Fumo. This is reported later on to Senator Fumo by either Scandone and or Kane, that that's what he was brought to the grand jury for. When he was before the grand jury, you heard my examination of Kane when he was on the witness stand. They asked him to make sure he didn't touch his computer. And the next day, by agreement, in lieu of a subpoena, the lawyer, Scandone, brings the computer down to be imaged by the government. Fumo thinks that this is under subpoena. Don't touch it. It may have Citizens Alliance-related documents relating to Verizon and PICO that the government is interested in. Fumo believed records couldn't be touched involving Citizens Alliance. And that's what's going on. Further evidence, what happens is this. Defense Exhibit 720.4.2. What happens is this. This is an email where Luchko, go down further, go to the bottom. He goes on to say he has a conference call with the FBI. And he goes on that they want to try and recover mail from Ruth's PC. And then go up. Here's what Senator Fumo's response is. About Citizens Alliance material. He says, okay, great job, thank you. I don't really care what they recover of her email. As long as we get copies of anything that is recovered, thank you. Is there a way to do that? And then he writes to Dick Sprague, why would we not want copies of anything they recover? So that's what this exchange, it's clear what's in his mind. It is absolutely clear what's in his mind about what is proper and what's not proper here. There is no intention to obstruct justice here. There is no criminal intent to obstruct justice, nothing like that. Is it a good time to take a break, Your Honor?
Good time for a break.
I reread either Elson or
at final exam period each semester.
I read it. Yeah.
So each of them three times. 6 years. I reread them to help me prepare for finals.
Got water, but you share it.
Start with me. He says this is a business
issue. Yeah. So I'm trying to change this, right?
I said, all right, but he said if this is more in the course of business, that was a great opportunity.
Yeah.
The reason why Steve.
We basically did it.
Well, we asked him whether he had any awareness.
And that question and the way he answered it.
Of course, tried to ring and let him know.
Hello?
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Cogan. Don't start yet. Okay. We're ready.
Well, I'm even more exhausted than I was when I started. But as you know, this is my last chance. And I'm trying to get through this obstruction of justice end of the case and trying to explain this in a way that at least conveys what our defense is. And I know it's tedious because you've seen them all the time during the trial. I mean, I don't want to ever see an email again. I really don't. I'm putting the government on notice. I'm throwing my computer out tomorrow from the second floor of my house. It's not obstructing justice. I'll give you my address. Take it. Take the hard drive. I don't want to ever see one of these screens again. You young people, I mean, you love them. Old guys like Jacobs. Why do they have, you know, these programs? You read it from the bottom up, and then you got to go, you know, to the second, to the third page, and then back. Shapiro understands this somehow. And one of the problems we had in this case is that he's in sync, but we're not. So you'll excuse some of the herky-jerky moments we had during the trial when it came to things like this. But this case is about emails. I didn't indict this case. The government did. So I can't just say, here are the themes, member of the jury. I'm not going to get into the specific documents in this case. And I can't make an assumption that by just saying things like advice of counsel, criminal intent, that he believed that this only covered Citizens Alliance at a particular time, that that's sufficient. But that would all change, though. On February the 18th, 2005, something happened. This is the day, as you well know, that a search warrant was first issued and then executed at the Tasker Street office seeking the hard drives and computer material at the Tasker Street office, the office of the Senate. Now, that's a critical day because according to the documents that I've shown you so far and the other documents that you've seen, it is reasonable for you to draw the inference in this case that what is in my client's mind is that anything before February 18, 2005 relates to documents of Citizens Alliance, and that's what this investigation was about. The government showed you some news story that was in the Inquirer again from May of 2004, investigation moves to Harrisburg, and that was about DCED grants to the Independent Seaport Museum, which they can get at the DCED. But this is when they're on notice of the very thing that Senator Fumo said in his conversation with Sprague, when he's reiterating with Sprague and the lawyers there, that up until February the 18th, 2005,
He thought this was just about Citizens Alliance. That's what we're talking about. So that policies did not change April 2004 to February 2005. This is what was in his mind. February 18, 2005, the FBI comes to Tasker Street. When the FBI comes to Tasker Street with a warrant for the server and the hard drives, the computer equipment that they want to take or image, they learn once they're there that the email exchange server is in Harrisburg. So they get the materials on Tasker Street that they need in record time, literally, very quickly, because the Sprague firm is simultaneously being given notice of the search just as the FBI gets there. Jeff Johnson and Mark Shepard from the Sprague firm go over to the Tasker Street office. And what happens is Shepard gets a pile of documents, the documents that have been served on him by the government, and he gives it to Mark Shepard. This is very important, and I hate to give you all this dry material, but it is critical in understanding some of the key components of this whole obstruction of justice end of the case. On February the 18th, as you know, you have the search warrant. Now what happens is this. Once the government learns that the mail exchange server is in Harrisburg, they work it out with the approval of my client. They work it out between the Sprague firm and the government that they can go to Harrisburg without a search warrant to grab the server in Harrisburg. And you might say, why do they have to do all that? Well, I tried to cover it a little bit when I had Agent Humphreys on the stand. A search warrant is a judicial order based on a showing of probable cause, that Fourth Amendment thing we talked about earlier, authorizing the agents to go to a particular place. Here it was Tasker Street, a place specifically described in the warrant to seize, to search for and seize items particularly described in the search warrant, and to seize those items at a time and place designated. It's a very narrow thing. It isn't you can search anything you want to search, anywhere you want to search it, and go any place you want. It is a specific place at a specific time describing specific items. So what happens is, instead of getting a new search warrant, the parties agree that the government can just issue a subpoena, a narrow subpoena, to get the email exchange server in Harrisburg, which they do. And that is the process that is out there at that. What do I mean by process? At the point when February 18th comes and goes, and the next day they go with the subpoena to Harrisburg, everything called for, either under the subpoena or in the search warrant, in the minds of the people involved, like the Sprague firm and Senator Fumo and the other people involved in this on the defense side, thinks the government has what it is that the government has sought. Now, later on, there is a dispute, and this is critical, and that's why I hate to get into the details of the procedure, but I ask you, I plead with you to bear this in mind. Much later on, we find out from Mark Shepard, when he is on the witness stand, that's the lawyer from the Sprague firm, that there is a dispute between the Sprague firm, Shepard specifically, and the government, Mr. Peace. That is that the government says in August or so, whatever happened to the other things we were seeking from the subpoena that was served on Tasker Street along with the search warrant. I don't want to be confusing about this. The other subpoena was the one that was issued later on by agreement to go to Harrisburg. On February 18, 2005, on Tasker Street, according to Shepard, what they think is outstanding is nothing, because they grabbed everything they needed and wanted and what was authorized over in the Tasker Street office on February 18th pursuant to the search warrant. But what happens is Shepard's now being told by the government in August or so, 2005, that there was a subpoena also calling for certain production of certain documents wherever situated. And this goes back and forth. You heard in the testimony that Shepard gave, this goes all the way into October or so. It's at that time or so that they go with a search warrant to Luchko's house, and where they find the very thing that the Sprague firm knew was in existence all along, and that was the backup tapes that are being prepared by Luchko. I hope this is not too confusing. My client gets charged in count 141, as I said before, for failing to produce or at least let the Sprague firm know so that they could produce for the government the very thing that the Sprague firm knew about all along. My client, not knowing anything more, obviously, than what Shepard knew, that there was supposedly embedded somewhere in those documents a subpoena at the time of the search warrant. Now, we saw that a subpoena was issued. Was it served there that day? Agent Humphrey says yes. We see nothing on there except her signature, nothing about Mr. Hoffman signing anything, the guy that was served one. Whatever, it doesn't matter. The fact is, my client thinks that they have everything they're looking for, and they are searching. What policy do we adopt going forward? Remember, search warrant, what's in existence as of February the 18th, 2005, not what is produced on February the 19th, 2005. Subpoena, any kind of subpoena, calls for production of documents that are in existence as of the day of the subpoena. So the Harrisburg server, the next day, if you get a new server, they've got everything that they had asked for in that agreed-upon subpoena. What is the policy going forward with respect to document deletion and retention that they're allowed to do now? What do they do? And we know what they do. There is confusion. The staffers, including Luchko, Eister, the other people, Don Wilson, they're looking for guidance. Senator Fumo is looking for guidance from the Sprague firm. Can we have a document retention policy? Can we delete emails? What are we required to do? What can't we do? What are the rules of the game here? And we know what happens. On April the 5th, in Exhibit 720.7, I told you, I don't like to see any more of these emails. Well, I got to show you one, but I have some hard copies, so I can read it a little bit better in terms of how this develops. In Defense Exhibit 720.7, there are a series of messages back and forth, and if Mr. Shapiro can coordinate this with my words as I look down, hopefully this will work out. But on page 12 of this exhibit, the series of emails that begin April the 5th, 2005 at 16:55 hours, which for non-military people, that's 4:55. It says, this is from Luchko to Wilson, and it said, with a copy to Fumo, it says, last week the senator told me that if users deleted mail, it was fine as long as we don't wipe the servers. That's what the senator told me. Now we are getting told something else. We have to get on the same page. What does Senator Fumo say at the top of the page at 5 o'clock p.m.? He says, Dick, I need some direction here. This sound like somebody with a criminal state of mind? Dick, I need some direction here. What policy should we adopt going forward? What can we do
and what can't we do? This man charged with multiple counts of obstruction of justice in light of this kind of evidence? If you start now on page 10, which is the next relevant message, it is Eister saying at 4:58 p.m. to Wilson, Don Wilson, and to Luchko. So this is from Mark Eister to Wilson and Luchko. He's got it. Great. Current situation is when mail is deleted, it's gone. The user has to be the one to delete. There is no dictate or advice from us, Len, you, me. I have no retention policy set on the server. I have no backups yet, so any mail deleted between February 18th and now is really gone. I have no clear dictate on what's going on. Lawyers say to not force deletions. Whatever that means. That's me editorializing. It doesn't say that in the email. Lawyers say to not force deletions. Charlie to keep it all. Fumo says, F it. Just forward it all to the FBI. You know, just click the forward command. So now what happens? You see this exchange. Says, sounds like Charlie, Fumo, and the lawyers need to sit down in the same room and talk. This is Eister, Luchko, and Wilson at 5:01 p.m. And then it says, right after that, at 5:03, from Luchko to Eister to Wilson. And I hope we're on the same page. Are we? Are we getting it up the screen? Okay. You're right. I CC'd the boss on my reply to Don. You and Charlie, we are going to get this taken care of once and for all. They're looking for a policy going forward. They're seeking advice of counsel. They're trying to do what is consistent with the requirements of the law. Because now Fumo understands that what he thought was his right and what he thought was the scope of the subpoena issued in April, that is that the policy remained the same from April 2004 to February 2005 because records of Citizens Alliance couldn't be touched. The other stuff could be touched. Now he's on notice that there is a problem with respect to what happens on February 18, 2005, with respect to other documents. Should they retain items produced after February 18, 2005? Now that the Senate and the Senate office is in the crosshairs of the government. So he's looking for advice. And what happens? You have these various communications going back and forth. They're trying to get an answer from the Sprague firm. And if we go to page 6, it says on page 6, if we can start there, this is from Luchko, this is from Fumo, this is from Luchko first to Fumo. It says, boss, I need someone to tell me what to tell Mark and Don, what to do as far as this email thing goes. Yesterday, Charlie tells Don he wants a copy of all email kept until we know for sure what we're supposed to do. I thought we had this all straightened out when we talked last week. I am not doing anything until I hear back from you because, quite frankly, I don't even think that it's possible the way we set up the new system. We're going to have to do something off the wall if you want to save a copy of everyone's email. And then you see consistently what takes place. The boss on page the next page, that is April the 16th, 09, Luchko tells Eister, this is what the boss told me this morning. I have talked with Jeff Johnson and Mark Shepard yesterday. They promised me that they will have a comprehensive answer to what to do by the end of the week. He's seeking further advice from his father figure, his dearest friend, his lawyer, the prominent lawyer. I only want to do what's right. Then you have the next email, April the 8th, 2005, from Luchko to Vince. Okay, I called Sprague's office and left the message for both Jeff and Mark, but they haven't gotten back to me yet. Let me know when they do. And he then writes back to the senator, still haven't heard anything, have you? Question mark. And then Vince sends an email to Jeff Johnson, to Mark Shepard at the Sprague firm, but a copy to Richard A. Sprague and to Leonard Luchko. Guys, do we have any answer yet? It sounds like there's a lot of confusion going on here, people looking for proper advice from counsel, people trying to do what the requirements of the law require them to do in light of the new development that took place in February of 2005. And then we find out the conclusion to all this, and that is Vince says to Johnson, guys, do we have any answers yet? And what Shepard says in response, April the 11th, days after this whole thing started, April the 11th at 3:30, we'll have an answer tomorrow. Mr. Sprague, you say you were like a father to my client, is that right? Yes. Not anymore, is that right? You could say that. Mr. Sprague, you say you were his dearest friend. Is that what you said on direct examination by the government? That's what I said. Is that still the case, Mr. Sprague? Are you still a friend of my client's? You're not a friend of his anymore, are you? You could say that. Mr. Sprague, you're the same Richard Sprague who appeared before Judge Young in 2007, the judge who had this case before our Judge Buchwald, remember? Appeared before Judge Young in 2007, and you said, when you were before Judge Young, at a hearing where you were the subject of the government's motion to have you and the entire Sprague firm disqualified on multiple conflicts of interest, you appeared before Judge Young, and what you said was this. You said, relating to things that occurred after February 18, 2005, this is what he said, and this is what I asked him about on page 124 of that hearing. There is no indication that one person from the Sprague firm knew one iota of anything about any wiping, deleting, until some time when Mr. Shepard, upon learning of it, sends out the communication that you've heard here, don't do it. And the communication that he's talking about is something that comes out something like April of 2005, 2 months after the search warrant is first served. And here is what we also know now. He told Judge Young that no one in the Sprague firm knew anything at all about any wiping or deleting, not one iota. At this hearing where he is being asked to disqualify himself, or that asking the court to disqualify him for multiple conflicts of interest, here is what we now know. We know, first of all, from that email that was sent by Senator Fumo to Dick Sprague about what Luchko had in mind. They're going to clean things off the server. You know what that means. They're going to wipe the server. But this is even clearer. This is Defense Exhibit 718. When I had Dick Sprague on cross-examination, I asked him, that was prepared by your firm. Is that right? Yes. Look what this shows. Can you all see this, or is it hard to see? I can bring it up. December 2004, GRJ, that's Jeff Johnson, and MBS, Mark Shepard, interview Luchko, learn of wiping of free, unallocated space and destruction of old VJF cards after complete copies are made. Luchko provides chart of wiping through 2004, but confirms wipes going since I got there. How do you stand up in front of a judge and say that you knew nothing, not one iota, about any wiping or deleting until sometime after the search warrant, when in fact, here, once again, just like on those notes, which are 722.3, RAS did as well believe that you don't have to save anything if it's not specifically subpoenaed, we find out that, according to Shepard, March 2005, initially advice from MBS was that employees at 1208 should not delete email going forward if it related to areas covered by warrant. And we know that everything covered by the warrant is anything that's in existence as of February 18, 2005. I hope this is not too confusing, but it's important to remember this. This is Shepard now. Otherwise, business as usual. Where did we hear that? This is the same kind of advice that Scandone's giving, that going forward, you can do whatever it is as long as it's not covered by the warrant. But more importantly, this is the initial advice given after they knew about wiping in December 2004 and deleting and the fact that it had been going on since I got there, with Dick Sprague representing to Judge Yon at that hearing on his conflicts of interest, saying we knew not one iota about any wiping or deleting until this advice goes out from Mr. Shepard, which anyone can see is 4 months after the meeting they had with Luchko. All at the same time that people are seeking further advice of counsel after the deplorable advice of counsel that Fumo got from Sprague in January of 2004 and from Scandone after all those gyrations on direct examination admits that what's in his letter actually happened. He told Fumo this is only about Citizens Alliance, he says, back in April of 2004, and you don't have to do anything other than business as usual with respect to the Senate stuff or your own stuff. Sometimes it is awfully hard to be fair. But the evidence is clear. The evidence is unambiguous. The evidence is so vitally clear that there is no criminal intent here whatsoever. Now, there's more. In Government's Exhibit 1599, Luchko and Vince are having a discussion. And what takes place in this email is that Senator Fumo and Luchko are having discussions at a time when it's clear the extent to which Luchko is trying to carry out policies, and he wants to make sure it's very clear from this email that Luchko doesn't destroy anything he shouldn't destroy. And what's he say? After Luchko explains what it is that he's been doing, here's what my client says to Luchko. Go and get all of my backups and give them to Roe, and also give her Jamie's PC card. I will keep them with me. Do not destroy anything. Do not destroy anything. He wants to make sure that these things are retained. Now that they've gotten some instructions from the Sprague firm about what to do. And now it really gets interesting. Because the government says, well, Jamie's PC card wasn't among the PC cards that Fumo turned over when he turned over his PC cards once he was told by the Sprague firm months later that there was a subpoena that was served at the Tasker Street office on February 18th, calling for other things to be sent over. By then, it's only Luchko who's holding Jamie Spagna's card. But my client hands over to the government seven PC cards. not six, not five, not four. And what does the government say? See, back in June of 2005, there's a wipe that took place. There's one wipe that takes place on a card that my client is giving them, as though he would know that Luchko had wiped anything, and who knows what was wiped. No suggestion that it had anything to do with this investigation. Nothing at all. Neither Senate stuff, Citizens Alliance stuff, or anything. So if, in fact, he wiped something consciously, that he himself, why hand that card over? Does that seem like someone with consciousness of wrongdoing, with a guilty mind? He turns the cards over. And what does the government say? Aha! He had all these neatly arranged folders. Remember that? Things neatly arranged. And then there are only a handful of Citizens Alliance-related emails, and they're all CYA stuff, as though there were anything else that was still around, given the fact that he has been deleting emails his entire career. Okay? That's so clear. I mean, there's this email with Mark Siegel about the Elton John concert where he says to Mark Siegel, I'm not really in control of Citizens Alliance. You know what's happening by 05? By 05, there are lawyers all over the place. His control is, you know, eroding pretty quickly. He's interested in the Elton John concert, but he makes that statement to Mark Siegel about the Elton John concert. But what really happens here is this. The government says he had 10,000 emails and only a few about Citizens Alliance. 10,000 emails? It shows you he's been deleting over the course of years. He says, my client, I mostly save personal stuff. You don't see on the card or the several cards that are turned over the stuff that would be consistent with the position that he has had all along. The stuff that shows that he is only acting in a way that he thinks is appropriate based on his understanding of what the subpoena calls for. That Howard Cain email, you don't see that there. That's not being preserved by him. He's not planning it out there for a defense. That Exhibit 1550 where he says, don't touch Howard's computer until you check it out with Jeff Johnson. It may be something covered by the subpoena. The email where he says to Luchko, my client, I don't care what of Ruth's emails they get. I just want copies. That's not on any of his PC cards. None of those things that would be a planted defense, which is what the government suggests, are there. 10,000 emails for a guy who gets 150 emails a day? A guy who you don't need to be Ed Jacobs to figure that's 1,500 emails in 10 days. All he's got is 10,000, a couple months' worth of emails for the entire course of the entire career that he's had, because they're absolutely being deleted in the normal course of the way he operates his business. Does he have in any of those other folders, the neatly arranged folders that the government told you about, his legislative accomplishments so that they would be planted there for the government to see? Is there anything in there about his budget triumphs in Harrisburg? We don't hear a word about that. Is there anything in there about all the things that he did for community and economic development, the $8 billion that Ken Snyder said that he brought to Philadelphia and this region for community and economic development, the things that he accomplished. Is there any suggestion that any of that is being kept there as some plant to give to the government? He gives the government cards which include an actual wipe done by Luchko. Do you think he has even any sense at all that there is anything there like that? As soon as the Sprague firm tells him to hand over the PC cards that he has off-site, which the Sprague firm knew they had things off-site this whole time. As soon as they tell him, he hands it over. He gives them his password. He's doing what he believes the requirements of the law happen to be. That's not all. Mr. Sprague, no longer the father figure, no longer the friend, the man who's the subject of the disqualification hearing for conflict of interest. This is the man who, after the indictment in this case, decides to hold a press conference. Decides to hold a press conference. And he tells the press, that my client was relying on advice of counsel. The press asks, whose idea was it for this press conference? Yours or Vince Fumo's? He says, mine. On the stand, before I reminded him of that, he said, oh, the only reason I had the press conference is that because Vince Fumo wanted me to have it. You mean you lied to the press? You think that's proper advocacy for your client? Why don't you just not answer the question? That's not all. In late 2007, he writes to a committee headed by a lawyer, or at least the counsel for the committee, a guy named Tim Arkin. This is the United States Congress. He says, and I'm not going to bring the whole thing up, just this portion of it. This man Sprague, who says to me in response to my question, you're saying you really didn't believe what Scandone was telling you about how he said business as usual, when in fact that's what you've been telling my client all along? What Shepard's telling him as late as March 2005, otherwise business as usual? What does he say to the Congress of the United States? This man, this father figure, this dear friend, the guy who my client continually looks for advice. In complaining about the government's conduct, selective prosecution, Sprague says, the last broad category of charges relates to allegations of conspiracy to obstruct justice. In this regard, Senator Fumo is alleged to have conspired to obstruct the investigation. In pursuing these charges, the government intentionally ignored documentary evidence of a long-standing document retention policy that the investigation is in parentheses and was followed until a search warrant was served in the senator's office. That's February 18, 2005. The government also ignored uncontroverted evidence of the senator's reliance upon, albeit erroneous, legal advice for much of the relevant period, putting it on Scandone. He tells Congress this, and he said, oh, well, you know, that's just a lawyer being a lawyer. That's all this is. You see what happened here. They start this investigation believing that there's extortion. Extortion, no. There are settlements that arise in his individual capacity and as a senator, not in the Senate, before the PUC where he's allowed to be as a litigant. They were wrong. What he accomplished was incredible. For ratepayers and for Citizens Alliance and for everybody else. Next, he continually seeks advice of counsel, even from the moment that the first email is sent out after the newspaper article where Scandone gets a copy, where the other lawyers get a copy, and where there are conversations with Sprague within a matter of a few days where he says you don't have to save anything if it's not specifically subpoenaed. And that's what happens in this case, members of the jury. That's your obstruction of justice case. And it is what precipitates the rest of this extraordinary case where, in the words of Mr. Zosmer, never saw anything like it before. I mean, corruption on a grand scale. No kickbacks, no bribes, no passing of cash under the table, no selling of one's office, nothing like that. Never saw anything like this. You'll never see anything like it. It's OPM extravaganza. I'm going to be moving on to another area. Do you want me to?
Are you going to move on to another area? Well, then we'll take our lunch break and return at quarter of two.
Okay.